Welcome to the April 2022 edition of ASAP Nowcast. This month in ASAP Now, you're going to find a lot of articles pertaining to children. The Benchmarking Alliance will be looking at where all the children's visits going as the percentage of those goes down relative to adults. Kids Corner is talking about migraines and occult infections. And we also have a Forensic Facts talking about how to evaluate your youngest victims for child abuse. In that vein, we also have an article that will help you to recognize human trafficking victims in the emergency department. And our cover is news from the front line, how emergency physicians in the Ukraine are coping. For this issue of ASAP Nowcast, I'll be speaking with Dr. Anand Swaminathan. He's a physician in New Jersey and a voice commonly heard on MRAP. He'll be discussing COVID therapeutics, an update for 2022. With me today is Anand Swaminathan. He wrote an article for our April edition to give us an update on all the COVID therapeutics, and there's a lot of different things that have been going on lately. I want to start off with all these monoclonal antibodies, because I think even since when we went to press this past week, the game has changed. So we had Regeneron, and pardon me, I'm going to butcher all of these names, bamlanivimab, etesevimab, they became obsolete after Delta, and then in Omicron we started using sotrovimab. Now I hear BA2 is coming out. So what's in, what's out with all these monoclonal antibodies?
It's such a good question, Cedric. And aside from the fact that we're not going to be able to pronounce these words correctly, I think it's really interesting because I think I had to resubmit this article like five times because the data was rolling as we're publishing it, which has been really hard during COVID. And so if you look at where these came from and what they do and how they work, you kind of knew that this wasn't going to hold up, that bamlanivimab, the first one out, was not going to hold up, because the way these have to be developed for the specific type that is out there, we knew that there was going to be resistance, and we knew that we'd never be able to keep up with those variants because the virus modifies and mutates far more quickly than we can create these monoclonal antibodies. We've tried really hard. And sotrovimab was kind of our go-to during Omicron. Whether it really helped or not is a really interesting question, because when you look at all of the data on all of these monoclonal antibodies, what we see is that they don't really study them in patients who were previously vaccinated, which, depending on where you are in the country, you might have a lot of vaccinated people or not as many. Where I am, most of the people that I see are vaccinated. And the other group they didn't study it in is those who were, or I should say, not that they didn't study them, but they couldn't prove a benefit in anybody who was seropositive for SARS-CoV-2 antibodies before they got the monoclonal antibody. And Cedric, we've been talking about this for 2 years. If you've already got a polyclonal antibody response, a monoclonal antibody isn't going to help you. And so finding that sweet spot of a group that can benefit from these was already very difficult. And then on top of that is the mutations and the variants that come out. So yes, when we talked about this for the article, when we put the article through, sotrovimab was kind of our go-to. But even in there, we kind of alluded to the fact that that was probably going to be gone soon. And now it's already been taken away from many places where BA2 is the predominant variant. And the one that we are told that we should be reaching for is bebtelovimab, which, aside from the fact that we can't pronounce it, is not available. Most places can't get their hands on that drug. And so I don't think we're offering any monoclonal antibody where I work right now. And I think most people are very short on these drugs. And so we're really having to ration and say, which is the group that's really going to benefit? It's very hard for us to tease out that group because we can't test for that seropositivity. Most of our patients are vaccinated. There's probably a role in those who are immunosuppressed. And then the other one that we have had for a little while, we're still using, is the Evishield, which I'm not even going to bother trying to figure out what the actual name of the drugs in Evishield are. And that's got a utility in the immunocompromised to give them a long-term artificial antibody response so that they can be protected. So right now, I would say that most physicians and most clinicians probably don't have access to a useful monoclonal antibody for BA2.
Yeah, say where we worked, we have a couple different sites. One's a county hospital, so obviously we didn't have access to it. And then there was another hospital that is more of a private payer. They did have access to some of the earlier monoclonal antibodies and were doing infusions. But yeah, that I've noticed that things have died down, and it has been very difficult in terms of figuring out who is the right population to give this to. Because as you were saying, in the vaccinated, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. And a lot of those earlier studies, I remember one of my buddies from medical school, he was doing his PhD where I was in medical school. So he's working for one of these companies now. And he showed me this paper early on that was like, oh yes, this works. But I was like, wait a minute, we have this whole group of people that it has to be seronegative. They've already either had it, or if it's a recurrent infection, or if they're vaccinated, this doesn't really apply to them. And trying to figure out how to actually make this work for people in real time, especially in the ER, is a really difficult thing to do.
Yeah, and the exception to that rule is those who have been vaccinated but are immunosuppressed and they're not mounting that same response or not having the same length of response, in which case I think these drugs make a lot more sense. And then, Cedric, I don't want to get into this necessarily because it's a whole separate topic, but if the funding lapses as it has right now, these aren't going to be paid for. So you and I work in underserved county-type systems where many of our patients don't have insurance. They can't afford these drugs even if they qualify and they need them.
Yeah, and I was having this exact same conversation yesterday. It's probably a topic to cover at a different time, but a great topic nonetheless. Let's go ahead and shift a little bit to antivirals, okay? So we finally have some oral pills to treat COVID. Nortriptyline, ritonavir, which is Paxlovid. We're probably going to call it Paxlovid because we can actually pronounce that. And there's molnupiravir as well. Which one is better? Have you written any prescriptions for any of these yet?
Yeah, well, the one that's better is the one that you can get your hands on. That's the simple answer. And both of these have utility, and having an oral pill for COVID is really beneficial, an oral antiviral. But there's so many limitations with these drugs. For both of them, they need to be started very early in the course of disease, within 3 to 5 days to have any utility at all, which, again, as emergency clinicians, we know after you get out of that phase, either the patient's going to get better, or they're already super sick, the viral phase is over, and now they're in that hyperinflammatory phase. So we have to be able to get these drugs to the patient very quickly. For Paxlovid, it showed about a 6% absolute reduction in hospitalization or death. That was a 90% reduction from placebo. So that sounds really, really good, but again, has to be given within that first 5 days in order to be effective. And it's got a lot of drug-drug interactions. And remember that the patients that are really eligible for these drugs are those who have comorbid conditions. So they're probably going to be on one of these drugs that has a drug-drug interaction, which makes it really hard because then we have to decide, can I peel away that drug that they're on in order to give them this short course of Paxlovid? Should I not be doing that? Fortunately, if you work in a place with an ED pharmacist, then you have that person to go to and be like, what should I do here? And this is why a pharmacist can be really useful to tell you, hey, that Paxlovid is going to interact with this medication the patient's on, and they probably shouldn't stop taking that medication. So those are the kind of things that we really need help with as doctors that we don't do all the time that our pharmacists can really help us with. Molnupiravir has a little bit less of those drug-drug interactions. There are some issues with molnupiravir from the perspective of fertility. So if you take molnupiravir, they tell you you can't get pregnant. You need to be on some kind of birth control. And for men, you shouldn't try to get somebody else pregnant for a period of time. And that's a hard one to enforce. I think that's where some of the problems come with molnupiravir. And then a lot of the infectious disease people tell you, if we keep using molnupiravir, we might be exerting a pressure on the virus to change, to mutate, so that it's resistant to molnupiravir. So that's going to be a problem as well. So these drugs, I think there's a lot of hope behind them. There's a lot of potential utility, but there are also a lot of questions. And I think one of the things that we really need to see with this is a quick and easy way to get the prescription for those who really need it. A lot of the pharmacies around me don't have either of these in stock and available. And so we need to know where to send our patients to get the drug, who's eligible for the drug, and then ideally is to take the physician or the clinician out of this mix completely. The patient says, I have symptoms, they get a test, the test is positive, and then somebody, not a clinician in an emergency department or even in a primary care office, writes a prescription for this drug and checks the drug-drug interactions. Again, another place where the pharmacist can be extremely useful and helpful in getting this. And this was the president's test-to-treat plan, which is exactly what you want. You walk into a drugstore, you take a test, test is positive, they check your medications that you're on, they check your eligibility, and they give you the script for either the Paxlovid or the molnupiravir. That's the only way to make this effective. And of course, the problem with that is going to be issues of equity. Who can get to a pharmacy with the drug in stock? Again, for my patients in Patterson, none of the pharmacies in the area have this in stock. So I can't easily get my patients to the drug, or my patients can't easily get to a pharmacy where they can just test and get the drug. So there's so many different issues here. It's going to be a drug that is going to be mostly used by those with means. those with good insurance, those who have telehealth where they can just call in and somebody can say, yep, you have COVID. Here's the script for the Paxlovid. It's going to be delivered to your door, or you can go pick it up at this pharmacy. That's the group that's going to get this drug. It's not going to be received by the group that really needs it, the group that is the most vulnerable and really needs to get easy access to this drug, or these drugs, I should say.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And these are some things that we've seen out there on Twitter. Craig Spencer's ER doc, he's a Ebola survivor. He was talking about doing a telehealth shift recently in New York and mentioned that there's a lot of young 20-ish, 30-ish year old people with no comorbidities calling in trying to get this medication. And again, it's something for which you are supposed to have comorbidities or be at risk of progressing clinically from just having upper respiratory infection, maybe lower respiratory infection, to somebody that would need hospitalization, oxygenation, or even an ICU. So yes, you're absolutely correct. Part of it is, how are we going to make sure that these medications are delivered equitably? And the president's test to treat plan works fine in theory if all of those things that you mentioned are in line. And again, even the testing part has been fairly difficult. I've traveled recently internationally and had to get 3 different COVID tests to make sure I could get to my destination within a period of 24 hours, because even though some of these tests are declared rapid, they're not necessarily available, or they're not as rapid as we think they are. They're not like having the ones that you can get mailed to you from the federal government, which, by the way, everyone, I think, is what COVID.gov you can go to. Hopefully you can get your COVID testing mailed to your house from there if you don't already have it, just in case whenever this next variant comes along and we have another spike.
And again, let's not forget about the funding issues here, right? Funding for the test, that needs to be free for people to get it, and then funding for the drugs, because they ain't going to be cheap. And this really speaks to how the power of the funding that we've had over the last 2 years and why we so desperately need continued funding for it.
You also talked about remdesivir, and I think a lot of us are familiar with that, usually because we admit somebody, they'd go into the hospital, hospitalists would start remdesivir with the idea that it's going to possibly reduce hospitalization days. But you talk about the Pine Tree study in your article, and it says there's a different role for remdesivir, but mostly in the outpatient setting to prevent disease progression. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, remdesivir, the whole way through, has been a Goldilocks drug. There's a specific place that the patient needs to be in order for remdesivir to be useful. They need oxygen, they need to be hospitalized, but they don't need too much oxygen. If they need too much oxygen, if they need non-invasive or high flow, they're not going to benefit from remdesivir. So there was this sweet spot, which told me that it was unlikely the drug was going to really have much benefit, which we've kind of found over time. The WHO Solidarity trial, the Discovery trial, both of these have shown that remdesivir probably doesn't have that much utility for inpatients. But Pine Tree actually was really hopeful, because what it said was, we're going to take patients super early when they're in that viral phase. We're going to give them intravenous remdesivir over 3 days. So one dose per day for 3 days. So an outpatient infusion. And what it showed was almost a 5% absolute reduction in hospitalization, a number needed to treat of about 22, which is pretty good. And again, it makes sense when they're in that viral phase, let me get them an antiviral medication that can help. Of course, it's all the limitations of, you got to have an infusion center. The patient's got to come back to the hospital 3 times to get this drug. There's obviously lots of expenses attached to it. And it's why that, even though it seems that remdesivir does have a utility here, we're not going to see much use for it because we have Paxlovid and molnupiravir around. So I have not given anybody an outpatient dose of remdesivir with the hope that they're going to come back 2 more times for me to give the next doses. And we don't have a very robust infusion center to support that. But there clearly are places that do, that can roll up, give a dose of remdesivir to people, and then come back the next day and give the next dose. We just don't really have that kind of a setup.
All right, excellent. Let's move on to steroids, which have, in the history of medicine, have gone from steroids in, steroids out, steroids in, steroids out. Nice thing for us, steroids are in for COVID. And right now, dexamethasone is one of those items that we're able to use, especially in patients that have hypoxia that need oxygen. But what about the patient that has mild hypoxia who you could manage at home with or without oxygen? What do you do with that person?
We're kind of shifting from that early phase of disease with the antivirals to the middle or later phases when it's that hyperinflammatory period that we want to really suppress. And Cedric, I used to work with a guy who's kind of a giant in emergency medicine, triple boarded in EM tox and IM. And he used to say that every patient deserves a dose of steroids before they die. Got to take a shot with the steroids before the patient dies. And there's a reason for that. because often these patients do get to that hyperinflammatory phase in their disease process, and we need to suppress that. So dex clearly has a benefit in those patients who need to be admitted who are hypoxemic. But right, what do I do with the patient who's 90, 91% when they walk around? They don't have a lot of comorbid conditions. They look like they can go home. They can follow up with telehealth, or they can follow up with their doctor. I might even be sending them home with a little bit of supplemental oxygen. Should I be giving that group dex? I think so. I think if they are hypoxemic, and they're not always hypoxemic, so these aren't patients who live at 90 or 92%. They're coming in now, they have COVID, and now they're 90, 91%. I'm comfortable sending them home. I would send them home with dexamethasone. I think that is the right thing to do for that small group of patients. Of course, what we see is lots of patients who get sent home with steroids who don't need them, who aren't hypoxemic, and there's no benefit in that group. And when there's no benefit, there's only the possibility of harm. So even though a course of dexamethasone probably doesn't have a huge amount of harm, there's some that's attached there. So we shouldn't be giving it to patients we're sending home who have no hypoxemia. But if they have a mild hypoxemia, they're comfortable to go home, I absolutely send them with a course of dex.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's pretty much the same philosophy that I follow. Because there are these folks that fall in this range of their oxygen's low, their SAT's 92 to 90 or so, something like that. They're not sick enough to be in the hospital, but I do want to do something for them. And I think a couple days of dexamethasone is the right thing to do for them. All right, let's shift a little bit. We were talking about steroids as an immune modulation. Let's talk about the actual immune modulators. And for those of you that remember all of your basic science in medical school, kudos to you. Swami, you're going to get to tell me what a Janus kinase inhibitor is and IL-6 inhibitors and all these things. So baricitinib and tocilizumab. How do these drugs work? Should we be using them?
Yeah, so these are inflammatory modulators. And I think the story behind the JAK inhibitors is that the lab that found the Janus kinase just called it just another kinase, and that became JAK Janus kinase. So that's the kind of origin story for that name. Basically, the way these work is by modifying the inflammatory cascade. That's as much as really we need to know. And honestly, we're not going to be prescribing these drugs very often in our hospitals. These are drugs that typically are going to be behind lock and key for the critical care docs and the infectious disease docs. And the reason is because they're fairly expensive. It's a fairly narrow group of patients who are going to benefit from them. They are patients with moderate to severe COVID who need to be admitted. They're in a hyperinflammatory state, which usually we will find out with inflammatory markers. The way that we can be helpful to the patient and to the team is to get those inflammatory markers. So I don't think every patient who comes in with COVID needs a CRP and an ESR. But I think that those patients who are hypoxemic, that you're admitting, maybe you're considering intensive care, I would go ahead and get a CRP and an ESR in those patients to help your critical care colleagues, your infectious disease colleagues, make the decision for tocilizumab or baricitinib. And what we found with multiple studies now, Recovery, the COVE barrier study, both of these seem to have a benefit in terms of reduction in mortality, but it really has to be only for those patients with a hyperinflammatory state. So you got to get those markers to see if they're hyperinflammatory. And then I would, if you really want us to get them started in your department, talk to your ID docs, talk to your critical care docs to get them started, because most of the time we're not going to be able to order them. Cedric, I think of this as the way it was when piperacillin tazobactam came out, where it's like, I knew that antibiotic existed, but I could never write for it. If I thought the patient needed it, I had to call ID or call somebody else in the hospital to sign off on it to make sure, because it was so expensive at that time. That's how tocilizumab and baricitinib are. It's not just the expense, it's also the scarcity of these drugs. We don't have a ton of it lying around, so we want to make sure that we are only giving it to those patients who really need it.
I feel really sad for you, because piptazo was like candy where I trained. And we just gave it out to everybody.
Sometimes in the waiting room, oh, you look sick, here's some piptazo.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's take a brief little break. We'll come back after the break to talk about how we address future science. All right, everybody, as we were talking in the last segment, I mentioned COVID.gov. This is the federal government's new website where you can go and check out things like COVID vaccines, where to get tested, advice about masking, and also check out your community level of coronavirus. So you simply go in there, you type in your county. I typed in mine in Texas, and it says that we're actually at low COVID-19 community levels, which is nice to be at. It's probably the lowest we've been since this time in the year 2020. So go there. You can also order 4 free tests from the federal government. Get those shipped directly to your house. I recommend you do that just in case another variant comes or there's another swing in your community where you might need to have rapid testing available. And now back to the program. Welcome back. We're with Dr. Anand Swaminathan talking about COVID therapeutics. We're done with all the actual medicines that we think we should be giving people. Now let's talk a little bit about how you sift through all this data. You've been looking through a lot of this stuff. I've heard you talking about things like absolute risk reduction, which is strange because a lot of pharmaceutical companies are never going to talk about absolute risk reduction. They're going to talk about relative risk reductions and make all their products look really, really good. In the beginning of the piece that you wrote, you talked a little bit about ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, which obviously showed early promise in the early stages of the pandemic. And I remember looking at some of those early studies, and some physicians bought into that really early on and continued to do it, even though now there are some randomized trials that are out that suggesting that those drugs are not effective. Really, what I want to know and what I think our listeners want to know is what's your process through sifting through all this data to figure out if we should follow one of these drugs or prescribe one of these drugs or not?
This is really tough because I think most physicians and most clinicians sit in the window of, I don't want to be the first to adopt something. I don't want to be the last. I want to be somewhere in the middle. But COVID kind of pushed us to embrace things sooner than we normally would. And that's why I think we were using hydroxychloroquine and even ivermectin and some of the other drugs that came out, because we had nothing to offer. For some of these drugs, we had a physiologic basis for why they may work. We had maybe some laboratory data saying that if you put SARS-CoV-2 and hydroxychloroquine in a test tube together, the hydroxychloroquine kills the SARS-CoV-2, which of course, Cedric, you and I know that you can do that with enough bleach too, and we're not going to drink bleach. We're not going to inject bleach. We know that that's harmful. And so we kind of have to look at this the same way. It's really hard though to sift through everything that's out there as this is developing. It's become a little bit easier now, because now that we have therapeutics that actually work, we're not rushing to jump on board with every paper that comes out. In general, what I would say is that if you see a paper that gives you a really big benefit for a really cheap intervention, you gotta question it a little bit, because it just usually is too good to be true, and there's a reason it is too good to be true. Once we have actual data, then we have to get rid of the physiologic basis. It doesn't matter if there's a physiologic basis for something. If the data doesn't really bear it out, if the really good studies don't bear it out, then the physiologic basis is wrong. And so then we have to move past that. And that just doesn't apply to COVID. That applies to everything we do, where we look at something like, physiologically, this should work. And then we study it and we're like, well, it didn't work. So let's move on from that. And hydroxychloroquine, we have randomized control trials telling us it doesn't work. And I think we've moved past that. Ivermectin, there are clearly still people who are using this, that are prescribing it. And the data tells us, the vast majority of the data and all of the high quality data tells us, that there is no role for ivermectin in the treatment of COVID-19. And I can't be more clear on that. There isn't a single good study that tells us we should be using ivermectin. And in the doses that we're talking about, there is a harm. You and I, we use ivermectin all the time for things like scabies. You work in a county hospital. I know you're seeing it as much as I am. And we prescribe that. And we don't think twice about the fact that I might see the same patient 3 times in a week and give them ivermectin for scabies. But this is continuous at a higher dose. And that is a much different danger. So we should not be prescribing hydroxychloroquine. We should not be prescribing ivermectin. And as far as knowing what medications to use, you got to have trusted resources. The bottom line, Cedric, is not everybody can take the amount of time that you and I do to sort through all this data. I get paid to do this. This is part of my job, is to read through all of this data. Most clinicians can't do that. They're working. In fact, they're working to support me in reading all of this stuff to try and tease it out. So you got to find trusted resources that you can go to say, is this useful or not? And that can be hard too, because there's a lot of mis and disinformation out there. I'm happy to share another time, or we can put it in show notes, the people that I use, that I go to and say, these are reliable people that I can go to for usable information. And I will just say that one of the ones that is not a reliable one, and we should be shying away from as much as possible and divorcing us from them as doctors and clinicians, is the FLCCC group, the Pierre Corey and Paul Merrick. Those guys are charlatans. They are trying to sell people snake oil. Anybody who says they're not making money off of it is wrong, because they are selling snake oil to people. Those are not the people we should be going to. You got to find trusted resources to sort through this data to help to support your decisions.
And I'd agree with you a little bit. I actually looked at FLCCC and their website in preparation for a talk that I gave in Saudi Arabia. It was about like how to identify bias in research and stuff like that. And I went back and looked at their protocols. And even this far into the pandemic, as of like February of this year, they still were recommending things like hydroxychloroquine, which I think for a year or so we've known, based on the best available RCTs, is ineffective. If they wanted to talk about, at that point in time, ivermectin, I think it was fair to discuss because it wasn't really, there weren't RCTs out at that point. But now that they're coming out, then the question is, when do you pull back on it? And that's my last question for you is this. I was having a conversation with one of our residents, one of the students that was rotating with us the other day, and we were talking about, when do you stop doing things once people have started doing them? And one of the things that we're thinking about is TPA for stroke, right? We had pretty good randomized trials back in, what, the 90s that said we should start doing TPA. Everybody started doing it, become standard of care. Now it's almost impossible to not give it. I mean, there's a huge debate in emergency medicine how we deal with that particular issue. I actually kind of felt that it was fairly similar to what we have going on with ivermectin in a way. Because, like, how do we determine, for all these people that are on board, when are they able to stop using it if they're going to follow the high-quality evidence? Or do we continue to call, what you said, call folks that continue to push this drug charlatans or quacks or whatever else?
We know that in order for something to get into our medical repertoire, it takes some time. But getting it out of our medical repertoire takes far longer. Once something has been accepted by us, we are very reluctant to embrace the new data and shift our mindset. And this has to do with our own cognitive biases. And that's part, or at least a big part of the reason why Alteplase remains, in spite of the fact that there is so much evidence saying that it probably doesn't do very much, or at least we haven't figured out exactly the population where it works. But it's very difficult for us to get these things out of our systems. We have to shift to a system where we are a little bit more facile with moving meds in and out because COVID is changing so quickly and it's such a novel disease that we have to be able to do that. So how do we do that? You're right. Early on, when we were using these medications, we didn't have a better approach. They were relatively safe. And so we figured, let's try it and see what happens. I can't really blame for the low middle income countries where they don't have access to things like baricitinib and tocilizumab and all of these monoclonal antibodies. I don't blame them for trying things like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin because they have them. They have them available. They can get them to their patients. They can do something. And I really feel for the clinicians in those kind of places where they're like, I got nothing to offer my patients, but I got some ivermectin hanging around. Let's see what happens. I do not in any way, shape, or form blame that group. And so I would never call somebody who is working in one of those low and middle income countries that's using ivermectin. I would never call them a quack or a charlatan. I would say that they're doing the best that they can given the best information that they have. For us, we have other options. We have good data, and that data should drive us to do the right thing for our patients. And so we have to get away from these things. I think that when it comes to hydroxychloroquine, any doctor who's prescribing hydroxychloroquine is an established quack at this point. And I would say the same thing for ivermectin. We've got enough high quality data to tell us there's no utility to it. And all of that being said, Cedric, and I know you feel the same way, if somebody comes out with a study tomorrow that's 5,000 patients, good double-blind randomized control trials showing that ivermectin works, I'll be the first to reanalyze my thoughts and jump off of my high horse and say, okay, I was wrong. Let's start using ivermectin. But we don't have that. We don't have that study. I'm ready to pivot if it comes out. But until it does, anybody who is prescribing ivermectin at this point is doing so based on no data, no data that shows utility. And so I think at this point, we can call them quacks. I would say that if you're still giving bamlanivimab, I would probably say that's kind of quackish at this point too, because we know it doesn't work. Fortunately, you can't get access to it anyway. Even if you wanted to give it, you can't give it. And that's kind of the way that we should be looking at these things. So I think, again, it is having trusted resources to tell you what are the most useful medications, what does the data tell us, what does the data drive us to do, and then that's what I am going to prescribe. And remember, in the beginning, we were giving azithromycin, we were giving vitamin D, we were giving all kinds of crazy stuff. But now we have better information telling us colchicine doesn't work, vitamin D doesn't work, azithromycin doesn't work, ritonavir, some of these other old antivirals don't work. Now we need to shift and say, we know they don't work, we should not be prescribing them, and anyone who is prescribing them is practicing bad medicine.
Thank you so much, Anand, for joining us and helping us sort through all the literature and all the current therapeutic updates for COVID-19, even though we're now like going on 3 years since the first case of this disease showed up. Thanks for joining us here on ASAP Now, and I hope that folks will give you a listen as well on what you do with MRAP.
Thanks for having me.
All right, thanks so much for listening to ASAP Nowcast, April 2022 edition. Next month, we're going to have an issue focused on mental health with a lot of articles detailing how emergency physicians are coping with the mental health challenges that are associated with the pandemic, and other items on how we deal with our patients that are arriving to the ED in some form of mental health crisis. Until next time, this is Cedric Dark, the medical editor-in-chief for ASAP Now.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the hosts and any guests. The music is Florence Price's Fantasy No. 1 in G minor for violin and piano.